Well, back in the saddle again. I won't sing that, but I will start though by expanding just a little bit on things that have already been addressed and spoken to this morning. But one of the learnings I have taken from this sabbatical really has been a reconfirmation of what I have long known. And that is what a wonderful congregation it is that I am blessed to serve. Back at the service that Burns Fisher and I did on January the 4th, which was the last Sunday service I conducted here as I was preparing to leave, he pointed out that a sabbatical is a congregational as well as a ministerial undertaking and opportunity. And in that spirit, I am deeply gratified at all that you have done on the congregational side of our sabbatical. Burns and the sabbatical committee is noted as did an outstanding job of both preparing for and carrying forth the Sunday services in my absence. But Jackie is also already noted going well above and beyond the call in any number of ways. At our staff meeting last Thursday, I had the chance to thank each and every member of our church staff for how they gave an extra measure of effort over the past 3 months, and I thank them here publicly for that now. Mike Bowes, Honcho, the Covenant Group program by absence, put together a very fine service about this very important aspect of our congregational life. Thank you for that, Mike. And our executive board, and you've heard some of that already, has gone the extra mile this past few months by attending to not just the usual business of the church, but going beyond that as well. And they've invited you to play a part now in this process of congregational discernment that Michael Doral urged us to undertake back in the fall. I hope you will take part in that beginning on this Sunday. I think John Sanders' leadership is, in this matter, as well as the overall board, is emblematic. Very fine leadership he's provided for us over nearly the past 4 years. Coupled with that, Steve Ledoux, Linda Guidi, Mike Wilton, who we've already heard from, the canvassers. It was a very well-conducted pledge drive. I hope you will keep those pledges coming if you have not done so already. I want to thank them very much for their time and effort also. One thing that was different on this sabbatical than the one I took 7 years ago, email had started 7 years ago, but it wasn't near as widespread as it is this time around. And so this being the age of email, I get copied on nearly all of the committee and board meetings that take place. And so it was really, as I sat there and would open it up each day, it was a bit of a challenge for me to decide how much and how little I wanted to know about all that was going on here while I was out. For all the ministerial, and as you know, the purpose of a sabbatical is to step away from the day-to-day and week-to-week doings of the congregation for some personal reflection and study and engagement and relaxation. And I think I was able to strike a balance between getting the distance that I needed in order for a sabbatical to be a sabbatical, while at the same time keeping myself well-informed enough so that I wasn't coming back in a complete state of amnesia after 3 months away. So as I say, I am pleased that you have demonstrated once again what a healthy congregation you are. For just as there are no perfect human beings, there are no perfect congregations. We're a human institution. But the level of maturity that we have here as a religious community is quite remarkable, I feel. Makes me grateful to be your minister, and it is good to be back. So what did I do? What kinds of things were on my mind while I was out? I'm not going to try to cram it all into one sermon today. We've still got a couple of months here together, a couple of pretty intense months together, actually, before we start gearing down for the summer, so there'll be time to speak to matters in the future. I'm going to touch on a few highlights in a kind of a potpourri fashion this morning. As most of you know, I spent the bulk of the last 3 months as the minister in residence at our Unitarian Universalist Theological School, the Meeple Lombard Theological School in Chicago. What I had there was kind of a combination of visiting faculty and general resource person position. I assisted in teaching a couple of the introduction to ministry classes, led some workshops and discussions, various gatherings about certain aspects of ministry that I figured those who were preparing for it needed to hear about, know about. Led some of the weekly chapel services, spent time conversing with faculty and staff members, and just generally kind of hung around. I had a third floor, walk-up apartment, in a student residence building next to the seminary's main building. And any time I had to leave my apartment, I had to think about going down 3 flights of stairs and back up 3 flights of stairs. From an alcove in that apartment where I had this laptop computer set up to work on a couple of writing projects I also wanted to pursue, I could look out over the roofs of the buildings of the University of Chicago, which is right in the same Hyde Park neighborhood where the seminary is. From time to time, I could walk up the street a couple of blocks to the university's massive Rockefeller Chapel. As huge a structure as that is, many of you have seen that, know what I'm talking about. The chapel also has a kind of spiritual intimacy about it, which made it a good place to just go and sit for periods of personal, very quiet relaxation and meditation. And so I use that chapel frequently to do that. Well, needless to say, much of the reading, writing, conversing, teaching, interacting, reflecting, and personal meditating I did was done indoors. Unless you happen to be one of these polar bear club enthusiasts, one does not visit Chicago in January, February, or March for the weather. Even for a New Englander, and even as a guy who lived for a few years in central Wisconsin, it was cold. My morning routine was to get up, put on some coffee, bundle myself up, go down those 3 flights of stairs, walk a couple of blocks to a store where I could get both the Chicago papers and the New York Times, walk back to the building, back up the 3 flights of stairs, thaw myself out, eat breakfast, read the news, and then get on with the doings of the day. I was pretty well awake by then. It was good to spend time out there with a couple of members of this congregation as they came through and spent some time at the seminary. Many of you know Lee Page, one of our longtime members here. Her membership predates mine, as a matter of fact. She was there for much of January, as she is in the seminary's modified residency program. She's getting close to completing her Master of Divinity degree and to enter the UU ministry. In early March, Arthur Grubinger came out to visit for a couple of days. He came there to investigate some of the school's special intensive study programs for persons who already have a theological degree, but who are looking to fulfill some particular requirements in order to become a UU minister. And so with Lee finishing up her program pretty soon, with Art looking to become a Unitarian Universalist minister, with Emily Burr being ordained here in May, with Jackie's ordination coming up at the Littleton Unitarian Universalist Church this fall, I would say that we here are certainly doing our share and helping to add some very wonderful folk the ranks of the Unitarian Universalist ministry. I think that is something that we as a congregation should take a great deal of pride in. Well, a couple of lifetimes ago, at least a couple of lifetimes ago, I lived in 3 different states in the Midwest: Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin. And so I used some of my weekends to go visit some old haunts and renew some old friendships with what folk were left in some of the towns that I had that I lived in while I was out there, and it was very good to go up and touch base with them. I even got in a trip down to West Virginia to help celebrate my mother's 78th birthday. She's just a couple of years behind Sheila. Michelle flew down for that occasion as well. And it so happens that my mother's birthday is the day before Jack Kerouac's birthday, which is... That's how I'm able to remember both of them. And I actually got a bookstore down there in Charleston, West Virginia, to let me do a Kerouac presentation and a book signing, another thing I came out with a few years ago. And one of the people who showed up for that event was an old high school friend of mine, who's now, has been for a long time now, a psychiatrist in Charleston, someone I hadn't seen in over 30 years. And I thought back to some of the stuff we did together in high school and thought, you know, and he's a psychiatrist and I'm a minister, who would have thought? But he and I retired to a coffee shop and ice cream parlor across the street from that bookstore, and we spent a couple of hours actually catching up on our respective lives there. Well, the winter quarter at Meadville ended nearly 2 weeks before my sabbatical time was up, and I figured 10 weeks of a Chicago winter gave me enough chits for at least one week in California, so off I went. Part of that trip was business. I needed to discuss with some of the people at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, a summer series course I hope to teach there a year from this summer, and part of it was just plain fun. Rick Mastin and I worked up a double bill gig at the Henry Miller Memorial Library in Big Sur. Rick, you've heard me speak of Rick Mastin before. He's a Carmel, California-based UU minister, poet, songwriter, troubadour, best known in UU circles for his song, Let It Be a Dance. Reverend Mastin, to use a designation he seldom uses himself, he's in his mid-70s. He has made a remarkable comeback in his ongoing battle with prostate cancer to the point that he's now hitting the performance circuit again. So when I was able to get this program event date set up down at the Miller Library, I called Rick up and asked if he would like to come down and join me there. This library, it's a bookstore, and it's kind of a general gathering place and watering hole for a lot of the local writers and poets and artists who kind of hang around in the Big Sur area. And when there's some kind of an event like this, they all come out. And so I asked Rick to join me and was delighted when he agreed to do so. And we drew a pretty good crowd on a very foggy Big Sur afternoon. And he read some of his poems, and I read from both my Kerouac book as well as a work in progress beat book that I used some of my sabbatical time to write. All in all, Rick and I had a real gas down there that afternoon. A few days later, I flew back to Chicago, got in my loaded up car, and began to drive eastward. My last overnight stop was in Rochester, New York, where I poked around the campus of my seminary, the Colgate-Rochester Divinity School. Just spent an evening kind of wandering around the campus there and thinking about some of the stuff that had taken place when I was there. Some very joyful, happy times, and some very poignant times I mentioned earlier, just when I was a student there, that we lost Dr. King. I had made a few trips back here. When I drove home, it wasn't my first time here in 3 months. I did fly back here on a few occasions, just so my wife and son would know I was still around. You do remember, I did say before leaving town that I would be back here to watch the Patriots win the Super Bowl at the end of, I did say that right here, and they did. Red Sox season starts today. I'm not making similar But this trip home had an obviously different kind of feel to it. This time there would be no plane to get back on to go back someplace, because this time I was actually home. Well, there were a number of religiously related matters that made and continued to make the news while I was out. I followed them with interest. I'm only going to speak briefly to a couple of them today. As I say, we still have some time before the church year ends to take up various issues. But the Massachusetts Supreme Court legislature was making the front page of the Chicago Tribune, probably with the same regularity that it was making the front page of the Globe and the Herald here. And the issue of the right of same-sex couples to marry continues to generate heat, probably more heat than light, more occasions than not. My support of the right of same-sex couples to enjoy all the rights, benefits, and responsibilities of civil marriage is a matter of public record, public in this community anyway, through some articles I've written for the Telegraph. I think that to use an overtly religious rationale to deny access to a civil contract is, as the Massachusetts Supreme Court correctly ruled, unconstitutional. And it is clearly the prerogative of any religious community, organization, or faith tradition to determine which marriages or unions it will recognize, legitimate, and sanctify, and which ones it will not. I would never contest that point. But since in the eyes of the state, the union of two persons is a civil contract, then as a matter of equal rights, I feel that contract should be available to all couples of legitimate age and relationship who want it. And I take this position as a religious leader. I will continue to do so. And then there was, and is, Mel Gibson's film, Passion of Christ. I know this one has already been, if you'll forgive me for this, pretty well flogged to death. But I'll try to nail it down as quickly as I can here. Full disclosure, I have not seen this movie yet. I rather like the book. Yeah, a little slow on that one. I even spent a few years studying said book rather thoroughly at the seminary where I just mentioned in Rochester, New York. And I will now cut the silliness and get on point. This is the Sunday, Palm Sunday, when I usually do offer, I spend a whole sermon offering my thoughts, my ideas, my reflections on the person of Jesus and how I do relate to the New Testament portrayal of him. I've not done that, obviously, today, since I wanted to share with you most of what I already have, but I'll give you a take for the next couple of minutes here anyhow. The main reason I have not seen this film is that however horribly, or benignly for that matter, the accounts of the final days of Jesus are portrayed, his trial, his torture, his death, and we really do not know how they occurred. What we get in the New Testament is basically a legendary account of a quasi-historical figure. Whatever that case may be, I take objection to how the alleged meaning of Jesus' death has, via certain Christian doctrines, overtaken the meaning of his life. Such an objection is hardly mine alone. The Universalist minister and New Hampshire native Hosea Ballou and the Unitarian scholar Thomas Jefferson had the very same objection, so I count myself in good company. Both of these gentlemen lived at approximately the same time. And it was Hosea Ballou's contention, which he stated in an essay which he wrote in 1803. His contention was that Jesus came to save humanity by calling us to our better selves by way of his life, teaching, and example, and not to deliver us from an inherently depraved state called original sin by his death. Neither Jefferson, nor Ballou, nor I would deny that humanity and that we human beings have a shadow or fallen side from which times can emerge some truly horrible evil deeds on the part of human beings. But, as both our Unitarian and our Universalist forebears maintain, we are not inherently defined by our depravity. And so classical Christian doctrine, I should say more orthodox conservative Christian doctrine, which Jesus himself never did espouse, by the way, holds that the horrible death Jesus had to endure is really what we human beings deserve because we're such sinful creatures. And that God, through Jesus, took on the punishment that we actually deserve. So, the more graphically Jesus' torture and death can be portrayed in a film like, say, Mel Gibson's, the more it drives home the point that this is what we actually deserve just for being born. I find such an idea to be utterly pernicious, and one that detracts from and really debases the meaning of Jesus' life. And it was the meaning of Jesus' life that Jefferson was trying to hold up when he compiled his little tract, which he called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, also known as the Jefferson Bible. So one of the many things that I mulled over during my sabbatical was how compelling the figure of Jesus remains in our culture, both within and without the Christian, within and beyond the Christian community. And to give some credit, Gibson's film certainly has demonstrated that. And I think perhaps those of a liberal religious persuasion, should maybe re-examine and reclaim the meaning of his life, especially since his death and all that is attributed to it has become so dominant. One need not be, as I am not, a capital C Christian in order to do this. But I am saying, drawing on some of my reflections of the past several weeks, that we might do well to recognize and hold up within our Unitarian Universalist communities some of the universal and humanistic messages found in the life and teachings of Jesus, instead of allowing him to become the sole property, as it were, of the increasingly powerful theological and political right in this country. And now you have my take on that. Now you know how I really feel. I'll finish this up with one more Sabbatical story. I mentioned earlier that I used some of my weekends to reconnect with some friends and places from my time I lived in the Midwest during the 1970s. One such trip was up to Madison, Wisconsin, where I visited the Reverend Max Gabler, G-A-E-B-L-E-R, Max Gabler, and his wife, Carolyn. Max was the minister of the First Unitarian Society of Madison, Wisconsin, for over 35 years. He retired from there in 1987, same year that our minister emeritus here, Don Rowley, retired. And I think, if my memory serves, and I tried to pull the dates on this one, I think it was sometime back in the fall of 1975 that Max got a call at his home one evening from this rather brash fellow he'd never heard of, saying he wanted to be a UU minister. Could have been a crank call, but the Reverend Gabler stayed on the line and listened to the story of an American Baptist campus minister who lived in a town 100 miles to the north called Stevens Point. The caller, as many of you know, was the 30-year-old version of yours truly. I was a stranger looking for a new religious home, and Max took me in and treated me warmly. And over the next couple of years, he helped me find my way to a new ministerial home as a Unitarian Universalist. I don't know if any of you've met him or not, but do you know he's a rather dapper, rather proper type gentleman. I think he was actually born wearing a bow tie. Harvard guy to boot, but without an ounce of pretentiousness about him. And after the Sunday service that he and I attended together at the First Unitarian Society in Madison, he and Carolyn, they're both now well into their 80s. They had me over to their apartment for lunch in this senior citizens complex where they now live. Max's mind is still sharp, and he's kind of slowed down a little bit. It took him a really long time to make the salad, and he kept filling my glass with wine while he was doing it. Slice of tomato. Here, Steve, have a little more wine. Slice of radish. Here, have a little more wine. To the point that I began to wonder if it was going to be safe for me to make the drive back to Chicago, but I assure you I ate well enough and I stayed around well enough eventually to leave with a clear head. And in the course of that lunch, which kind of spilled over into the dinner time, I tried to give Max this quasi-rehearsed speech I had about how grateful I'd always been to him for responding so enthusiastically to me when I first contacted him out of the blue about being a UU minister close to 30 years ago. Self-effacing guy that he is, he just kind of waved me off and made a few of his characteristically kind and generous remarks about how he knew he was doing the right thing then. Well, whatever the case may have been, I know I made the right choice for myself, as the ensuing years have borne out for me. So Max helped me find a place to be. And he helped me find a direction to take. But my religious and spiritual journey, to say nothing of my career, was in need of a new and more meaningful course. And that, I believe, is also one of the many reasons why we are here. We are here to respond with enthusiasm and grace and support to one another in our journeys of meaning and spirit. We're here to welcome into our midst those who find they need a new home and a new sense of direction. So it is good to be back with you as we continue in that task and in that call.